Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Few figures in history have inspired as much study and an interpretation as Abraham Lincoln. The 16th president is remembered in countless books and movies as he lives on in our minds as Honest Abe, the Great Emancipator. Joining us today is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Eric Foner, whose latest book, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery, has been lauded as an essential work for all Americans. He'll be discussing the book tonight at Ohio Wesleyan University in Delaware. For more information, go to the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Eric Foner, welcome to the show.
Very nice to be here.
You've written that politicians from conservatives to communists, civil rights activists to segregationists have claimed Abraham Lincoln as their own. What's that broader appeal? What's the common denominator?
Well, I think the common denominator is the very unique place that Lincoln occupies in our culture and in our historical memory. I mean, Lincoln seems to embody characteristics or qualities that we think are quintessentially American. You mentioned a couple of them. Honest Abe, also, of course, the self-made man who pulled himself up from, you know, very humble beginnings, the frontiersman and the liberator of the slaves. So to get Lincoln on your side in political debates gives you a position of formidable strength. Also, there is the fact that there are a lot of Lincolns out there and that Lincoln, you know, Lincoln held many different kinds of ideas during his lifetime. So you can pick which Lincoln you want to have on your side. It's not false to say that he was a forerunner of conservatives. It's not false to say that he was a forerunner of liberals and radicals. His views on race included some things that are associated with segregation and some things that are associated with civil rights activism. So therefore, if you pick and choose, you can find those aspects of Lincoln that seem to, you know, coincide with modern day politics. But, you know, Lincoln is maybe the most iconic figure in American history.
These days, when a politician changes his or her mind on a topic, they're called flip-floppers, and some politicians appear to be changing their minds on topics just to get votes. You wrote that the Lincoln we should remember is the politician whose greatness lay in his capacity for growth, which is like change, right?
Well, yes. Lincoln lived, of course, during an incredibly, you know, complex period in the middle of the greatest national crisis that we have had over slavery and the Civil War. My book argues that this capacity for growth, change, whatever you call it, he had an open mind. He was intellectually curious. He was not fixed in his ideas. In a time like that, to be fixed in your ideas, I think, would make it almost impossible to respond to events. So, yeah, you could call him a flip-flopper, or you can call him someone who actually was able to recognize when old ideas were no longer relevant, when new approaches were necessary. And you're right. Of course, today, if a politician changes his mind, we don't seem to want politicians to rethink their views, which it doesn't seem like a very, a very intelligent way to think about how politicians ought to operate.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest is Eric Foner, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, professor of history at Columbia University. If you have a question or a comment for Eric Foner, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You could email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about his book, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery. You can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us at WOSU All Sides. So when you said it at a time like that, so have times changed? Have we changed? And what we'll tolerate from our politicians? Because you said you'd think that we'd want our politicians to consider things
to grow and
to change.
Well, of course, our politicians do change. President Obama, they don't say they're changing. President Obama has changed his views, let's say, on gay marriage. He says those views have evolved or are evolving. Fine. Governor Romney has changed many of his views on health care. You know, he's really one of the originators of Obamacare in Massachusetts, but he now rejects that. On abortion rights, he's changed his views. Fair enough. If you can explain why your old view was not adequate, why you have altered your views, not simply to appeal to one part of the electorate or other. I mean, my book is about Lincoln and slavery. It's not a full biography, mm-hmm. but certainly on the issue of slavery, the fundamental question of 19th century America, Lincoln, at the end of his life, was held far different views than he did earlier on, and also on the question of race and the role of African Americans in American life. And on that, he started out sharing many of the prejudices of that society. I think he ended up in a place which was much more egalitarian. And I think the events of the Civil War era kind of persuaded him to expand his horizons and develop a more humane view, so to speak, toward the place of blacks in American society.
I guess sometimes there's this distinction, I guess, between changing your mind about something and not changing your essential, who you are essentially. And
right.
he didn't seem to change who his essential self was.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Lincoln always hated slavery. There's no question about that. He had this moral compass, you know, which was fixed all the way through. On the other hand, hating slavery does not tell you what to do about it. And many people in that era who hated slavery were kind of at an impasse. The Constitution protects slavery. State law protects slavery. There was nothing that a man like Lincoln, who's in Illinois, could do to abolish slavery in Mississippi or South Carolina. So there was a wide range of views about how to deal with the slavery question, and Lincoln occupies different positions on that spectrum at different times in his life. How do you act within the Constitution? Then when the war begins, how does that affect your views about slavery? You don't want to cause tremendous disruption, although the end of slavery, of course, requires that. So, yes, I think it's a good point. Lincoln's moral hatred of slavery remains the same, but the way he deals with it changes enormously over the course of his life.
Did he do a good job? Was he good at explaining himself?
Oh, brilliant. You know, one of the things that I came to be more and more impressed with as I was working on this book was simply Lincoln's command of the language. I think he was the most brilliant writer we've had as president, other than possibly Thomas Jefferson. And remember, he was totally self-educated. He only had 1 year of formal schooling in his whole life. So, yes, he explained himself with incredible clarity. There was no ambiguity about where Lincoln stood on issues. And in speeches, particularly, and public letters, Lincoln, you know, analyzed the politics, the issue of slavery with amazing clarity. And so, you know, we don't have a lot of private correspondence of Lincoln. He didn't write a lot of letters. He didn't keep a diary. So if you want to analyze Lincoln, you got to go with his public statements, his public actions. But luckily, those are so clear that you can sort of really get to the heart of what he believed.
I was surprised that he wasn't much of a writer, a casual writer. I was surprised he really didn't keep a journal. But he was a great writer, and I was always taught that to be a great writer, you have to write. and I wondered if you think, or if anyone's ever supposed out, that there's more out there that's been lost or destroyed or hidden.
One would hope so, but I tend to doubt it.
Yeah.
I think we know everything that there is to know about Lincoln through his own words. In other words, all the letters that Lincoln wrote, I think, are known. Maybe someone will find a trunk in some attic somewhere with a whole bunch of new
stuff. Antiques Roadshow can only help.
Maybe so. I think it would be unrealistic to hope for that. All his speeches, of course, are out there. His legal arguments are out there. So it's really a question of interpreting them, not digging up new information.
Did he write several drafts of speeches?
He was a very careful writer. Okay. He chose his words incredibly carefully. So he did write drafts, and he did research. You know, one of his greatest speeches, the Cooper Union Address of 1860, in which he lays out his views to an Eastern audience for the first time in New York City, and that speech, many people feel, kind of announces him as a presidential candidate. You know, that's like almost an academic treatise. When it's published, it has footnotes. How many political speeches today come out with footnotes? But he had researched it in the state library in Illinois. It's about the views of the founding fathers on slavery and how he argued he, in trying to oppose slavery, was following in the tradition of the founders. And, you know, he uses the debates of that period and the letters of Jefferson and others. So he's a careful writer. He's a careful researcher. He does go through drafts. And when he's finally satisfied, it's a pretty, you know, excellent exegesis.
he predicted that blacks could never achieve equality in the United States and said that they should instead colonize elsewhere for that sort of freedom and self-government. So that's kind of something he changed on or came to.
Well, yeah. I mean, we don't remember, perhaps, that this idea, which was called colonization, that is, that slavery should end, but African Americans should be encouraged, or in some people's view, forced to leave the country for Africa, for Central America, for Haiti, something like that. We don't remember that that was a very prominent view, at least among white Americans. Thomas Jefferson believed that. Henry Clay, Lincoln's political idol, believed that. And for at least 10 years, Lincoln believed it. Lincoln was an advocate of colonization. He was a member of the Illinois Colonization Society. Now, his view of it was a little different than others. You know, Henry Clay said, well, why should blacks leave? Well, because once they're free, they're incapable of living in freedom. They're violent. They're dangerous. They'll disrupt society. We don't want free Negroes here. That's not what Lincoln said. Lincoln said, racism is so deeply entrenched in America that blacks will never achieve equality here. So therefore, they are entitled to the natural rights outlined in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. They're entitled to these rights, but they can never really enjoy them here. And therefore, it's better for both races to be separated. Now, after the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln drops this idea. And in the last 2 years of his life, for the first time, I think, he starts to think seriously about America as a biracial society. What will be the status of these emancipated slaves in America, not somewhere else? And I argue that one of the key reasons for that is the service of black soldiers. You know, Lincoln, the Emancipation Proclamation announces that blacks will be enlisted in the Union Army by the end of the war. Something like 200,000 black men have served in the Army and Navy. And I think Lincoln and many other white Americans come to feel that by fighting and dying for the Union, they have staked a claim to citizenship in the post-war republic. So it's a very different concept, telling blacks they got to leave the country and telling them, no, go into the army and fight for the nation.
What kind of trajectory do you think he was on before he was assassinated in terms of, you know, where he was going with that?
Well, this is what we call counterfactual history, right?
Yeah.
I don't mind talking about it, but it is speculation. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at the trajectory of his life and his movement in the Civil War toward the abolition of slavery and toward greater equality for blacks, there's no reason to think that that would have just stopped when the Civil War ended. He would have stopped growing. He would have stopped changing. What exactly would have happened, nobody knows. But I think the whole country was changing. The Northern opinion was moving, you know, radically toward greater equality for blacks. I mean, a year after Lincoln dies, you get the 14th Amendment passed, which creates equal citizenship for black people for
the
first—
Which the Emancipation Proclamation did not achieve.
No, it had nothing. The Emancipation didn't say what their status would be.
Mm-hmm.
The 14th Amendment puts into the Constitution for the first time the notion of equal citizenship for all those born in the United States, black or white, regardless of race. A year after that comes giving black men the right to vote in the southern states. So opinion is changing rapidly at that time, and there's no reason to think that Lincoln, who had his finger on the pulse of Northern public sentiment, wouldn't have been changing also.
Did he know blacks?
That is a very good question, actually, you know, and it's one of the things I found very interesting in researching. Before the Civil War, no, he didn't know very many. You know, there were a couple of blacks who worked in his home, black women as you know, domestic workers. But that's not really knowing someone. He befriended a black barber in Springfield and helped him with some legal matters. But he had no contact with active, articulate, you know, black—
The great minds of the day.
—political leaders.
Mm-hmm.
As president, he gets to know them. You know, one of the interesting things about Lincoln, he is the first president to actually have blacks in the White House. I'm not talking about slaves.
Mm-hmm.
As citizens, Frederick Douglass meets with him. Sojourner Truth meets with him. Martin Delaney meets with him. Alexander Crummell. Lincoln shares prejudices, but he doesn't seem to have a visceral dislike of black people. He can sit there and talk to them as equal citizens without any problem. And I think contact with these politically active, you know, very intelligent black people changes his mind. It introduces him to, you know, people who are like himself. I think he saw Frederick Douglass as a kind of kindred spirit, you know, a guy who had pulled himself up from his own boots, you know, from a very humble beginning by his own efforts, and who had done it through his mind, you know, through intellect, Not by just working hard out in the fields. Both Lincoln and Douglas figured out very early, if you want to get ahead, it's through learning, not just through hard work, you know. And I think Lincoln and Douglas got along quite well because they were two peas in a pod, in a sense, even though they came from such different backgrounds.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Eric Foner. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, turmoil in Afghanistan. U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker is just out, and he's talking critically. He joins us. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 59 degrees with sunshine, warming up to 74 today. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 53. Mostly sunny for Friday. There is a chance of an afternoon shower, a high of 74. And then rain is likely Friday night, a low of 54 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from Thurber House, presenting CNN's senior legal analyst and bestselling author Jeffrey Toobin, reading from his latest book, The Oath, The Obama White House versus the Supreme Court, Monday, September 24th at the Columbus Museum of Art. Tickets at thurberhouse.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Eric Foner. Eric Foner will discuss his latest book, The Fiery Trial, tonight at 8 at Ohio Wesleyan University. You can learn about this free event. It's open to the public as well. Go to our website at wosu.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you. If you'd like to speak with Eric Foner, have a question or comment about him, we're talking about Abraham Lincoln. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jerry in Northwest Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fisher and Mr. Foner. You know why Lincoln's enemies called him an infidel? He was the only president who never joined a church. I've got an article that my mother, who was a great historian, sent me 45 years ago by Louis Cassels, who was a religion editor of for Associated Press at that time. But Lincoln was also the most Bible-read president of any of them. And he wasn't a hypocrite. He said, when that church comes along that says, through these doors, any person can enter, I'll join that church. But he saw the prejudice in many of these churches at that time. Mr. Foner, I'd like to ask you if you're aware of these things and if the Dred Scott decision, the year my grandfather was born, 1857, was a prelude to the leading up to the Civil War. And thank you for your time.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thanks for your question. Well, first of all, as is always the case, listening to your mother is a good idea. She was on to something here. Yes, Lincoln never became a member of a church, and Lincoln's religious views are the subject of a lot of debate and controversy. I think the best way to describe it is, in his early years, he was what they called in the Revolutionary era a deist. That is, God had created the world, and then sort of left, you know, and to worship God, you study the laws of nature, you know, the Newtonian laws, and there was no point in prayer or in asking for miracles or anything like that. He was not a believer in organized religion at that time. And indeed, when he ran for Congress in 1846, he was accused by his opponent, who was a Methodist minister, of being an infidel, and he had to respond to that. During the Civil War, I think his views begin to change a bit in the sense he begins to think about the possibility that God does intervene in worldly affairs, although in ways human beings can't fathom. And in his second inaugural address, he talks about this. He says, you know, both sides pray to the same God, but we don't really know God's will. Now, we've come a long way since Lincoln. Today, every politician knows God's will and will tell you immediately that God, he knows what God thinks about the budget deficit. He knows what God thinks about Afghanistan, everything. And to run for office and not be a member of a church is almost inconceivable today. People wear their religion on their sleeve. Lincoln was not like that. Now, of course, he understood that as today, evangelical Christians were an important part of the Republican Party, and he appealed to them. He had days of thanksgiving and fasting during the war. And as you say, he knew the Bible up and down, absolutely. But, you know, that's how you learned at that time. The biblical cadences are in Lincoln's writing. You know, every book, every household had the Bible, and maybe that was the only book they had. So he read the Bible very carefully. He knew it. But he did not feel – he rarely talked about Jesus Christ. He didn't see Jesus as a personal savior. So his religion was very, very different than most Americans at that time.
Was he – did he come from a faith? Were his – did his people
Well, his
have,
parents were Baptists. Okay. In Kentucky, where he was born, but you know, and they were members of an anti-slavery branch of the Baptist Church down there, but you know, so they had the Bible, but Lincoln never found organized religion very appealing.
From Ben on Facebook, he asks, did Mr. Foner in his research find Lincoln-era campaigning as cutthroat in comparison to today's campaigns, or did there tend to be more respect, gentlemanly politics occurring?
Gentlemanly, no. I would definitely say the politics was not very gentlemanly. But the and the tone of politics could be as unelevated as we have seen perhaps today. In the campaign of 1864, where Lincoln was running for re-election against General McClellan, the Democrat, the Democrats basically just appealed to racism. That was their campaign. Lincoln has freed the slaves. They're going to come up. They're going to take your jobs. They're going to rape your daughters. It was about as explicit racism as you could imagine. On the other hand, the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858 were serious discussions of the fundamental question facing the country, slavery. I don't think our presidential debates in this campaign are going to be at the high intellectual level of the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858.
Hameen in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My quick question, and I'll take it off the air. I'd like your comment. Given the fact that Douglas, Frederick Douglass, such a towering intellect of that time, had Douglas been a European and he'd been able to compete in the political arena, would we have even have heard of Abraham Lincoln?
Another counterfactual question. You know, Frederick Douglass was a great American and a great thinker and a great writer. He was, of course, born a slave. He was African-American. There was no way at that time that Frederick Douglass could be elected to any office, unlike today when we have an African-American president. But, you know, Douglass's influence was exerted outside the political arena, or maybe I should say the electoral arena. He gave speeches. He published newspapers, magazines. He wrote letters. He affected public opinion, which in many ways is a more powerful thing than simply getting elected to office. So, you know, what would have happened if Douglass were white? God knows. You know, that's an impossible question to answer. But as an African-American, he exerted a tremendous amount of influence on public affairs in the Civil War era.
Thanks for your call, Hameen. Take care.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Coming up later today, a news conference with the superintendent of Columbus City Schools, Gene Harris. WOSU has confirmed through an anonymous source that Columbus City Schools Superintendent Gene Harris will announce her retirement during that press conference this afternoon. The source says her retirement will take effect at the end of the school year. Her announcement comes as the district continues to struggle with allegations that administrators retroactively changed attendance records. For more on that, stay tuned to 89.7 NPR News, and we'll have the latest later today. An email from Bob to Eric Foner, my guest, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. Bob writes, this past Tuesday, PBS showed Death and the Civil War. It depicts a society realizing that it had to increase services, especially burying battlefield dead. Might your guest comment on any pertinence of Lincoln's policy decisions related to the high number of deaths during the Civil War?
Well, of course, that's a very good question. And the Civil War was a devastating event for American life. The current estimates are maybe that 750,000 Americans, North and South, died in the Civil War in a population of about 30-some-odd million. If you multiply that out to today's population of over 300 million and the same percentage, you're talking about over 7 million deaths, which obviously would be a tremendous blow to any society. More people died in the Civil War, more Americans probably, than in all the other wars of this country put together, from the Revolution to Afghanistan. And how to cope with that, and of course that TV show was based largely on the excellent book by Drew Faust, the president of Harvard now, on death and the Civil War. How to cope with that was a tremendous burden or problem or challenge for Lincoln and for the Confederacy as well. I think Lincoln, although a humane man, was willing to fight that war to preserve the Union and then to abolish slavery. He felt that the loss of life was somehow justified or at least legitimized by the consequences of the war, the end of slavery and the preservation of the Union. Lincoln was not a violent man, not a bellicose man, not a bloodthirsty man, you know. In fact, he was very peaceful. He never fought in any war before this, but he thought the loss of life was worth it for the ends that the war was pursuing.
He signed the Emancipation Proclamation, it was about 150 years ago,
yep,
last week.
Well, the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, actually this Saturday, the 22nd, we're coming up, or whatever that is.
On the big day. Okay.
We're coming up to the 150th anniversary
next
of the
week,
preliminary
yeah.
Emancipation Proclamation, which is basically a warning. Lincoln says, if you guys don't stop the war by January 1st, I am going to free slaves in the Confederate area. Of course, they don't stop the war, so January 1st is the 150th anniversary of the actual Emancipation Proclamation.
But he's going to free slaves, especially slaves that can fight in the war.
Well, all slaves in Confederate territory will be declared free. But now, not in the preliminary one, but in the final one, he opens the Union Army to black enlistment for the first time. So, yes, it's partly that's one of the motivations, to get more men into the Army, because at the beginning of the war, blacks try to enlist, free blacks, and the army says, no, this is a white man's war. We don't want blacks in the army. But by this point, you need every man you can get. The bloodshed is such, the casualties are such, enlistments are falling off. You can't just ignore this reservoir of black manpower. That is one of the numerous motivations for the Emancipation Proclamation.
I was interested how you write that the emancipation was not achieved with a stroke of a pen, rather that it was a long, complex process of wartime emancipation that pretty much started at the Fortress Monroe, Virginia, where General Benjamin F. Butler commanded. Can you tell us about that?
Right. You know, I think this is an important thing as to understand the history of that period. Emancipation is not one moment, it's not one event, and it's not one person. It's the result. It's a long process. It ends when the 13th Amendment is ratified in 1865, irrevocably abolishing slavery throughout the country. And yes, I think it does begin at Fortress Monroe in Virginia, right at the beginning of the Civil War, where slaves run away to the Union fort. They seek refuge, Virginia slaves, at the fort where Benjamin Butler is the commander. The policy of the Union at that point is that we are not fighting against slavery and we are going to return fugitive slaves. There's still the fugitive slave law on the books. Butler says, no, I don't think that's a good idea. These slaves have been working on Confederate fortifications. Why should I send them back to help the Confederate army? I'm going to open the fort and let people run here. That'll weaken the Confederacy. Lincoln allows that policy to stand. He doesn't say anything publicly, but he allows Butler to continue to accept.
It's based on the idea that they're property, though, actually.
Well, he says they're
contraband.
That's what Butler says. Yes, these are property, and in war you can seize property that is being used for military purposes by the enemy. That's fine, but then what happens when women and children turn up? Butler says you can stay also. In other words, they're not just contraband. They're just slaves running away to try to get their freedom. So it's important to remember, Lincoln is not just the guy who frees the slave with a stroke of his pen. Slaves themselves are taking action from the beginning of the war, which is putting the issue of slavery on the national agenda and forcing the Lincoln administration to start making policy about slavery. So, as I say, there are many actors involved here, and emancipation comes as the result of many, many people's decisions and actions.
William in Cleveland, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, William.
Yes. Thank you. I think you have a great program.
Thank you.
And my comment, you know, she asked me to make it in one sentence. You know, it's hard to express something in one sentence.
Yeah.
You know, it's a form of, what I wanted to say is Thomas Paine wrote the article, African Slavery in America, in 1775, about April 12th, and then he formed 2 weeks later, a month, the first abolitionist group, and I think that may have been the most important event, because the abolitionists, it grew like wildfire in the North, and that was the main reason that the slaves were freed. The abolitionists forced President Lincoln to free the slaves. He really didn't want to free them.
Well, the abolition.
From what I read.
Thanks. Yes, Tom Paine in 1775, and I actually wrote a book about Tom Paine a long time ago, it's not quite clear if he wrote it, but anyway, he published an article condemning slavery in the Pennsylvania Magazine, which he was editing at that time. And the Pennsylvania Abolition Society was the first official organization demanding the abolition of slavery, and they were important. Benjamin Franklin eventually becomes the president of that. The abolitionists are important, absolutely. They're important for raising public opinion or consciousness, arousing public sentiment about slavery in the North. However, to say they spread like wildfire may be an exaggeration. Abolitionists, even right before the Civil War, were a small group. They were very prominent in some places, like Cleveland, for example, where you're calling from. But in most parts of the North, they were very few and very unpopular. There were riots against them. Where Lincoln came from, Springfield, Illinois, there were no abolitionists. In fact, his position, which was not abolition but stopping the westward spread of slavery, was not all that popular in central Illinois and southern Illinois or southern Ohio, which are places settled from the South. So, you know, the abolitionists are part of the equation, but they're and an important part, but they're not the whole story. That's for sure.
William, thanks for your call. Thanks for your concise reflections on Thomas Paine's role in the abolitionist movement. We appreciate it. Thanks. Take care. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Eric Foner, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. We'll continue our conversation after this.
I'm General Manager Tom Ryland, congratulating the WOSU News Team for being named the best radio news operation in Ohio and for winning Best Radio News Website. Hear more from our news team on 89.7 NPR News and online anytime at WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and we'll talk about a relatively new perspective on child rearing. Renegade parenting is the discussion on Hour 2 of All Sides from 11 till noon. And it's 60 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine and a high of 74 for today. Partly cloudy tonight, a low right around 53 degrees. Expect sunshine and a high of 74 on Friday. There is a slight chance of a pop-up afternoon shower. And then rain is likely for Friday night, a low of 54. Support for 89.7 comes from United Way of Central Ohio. United Way is working to improve lives and strengthen our community by bringing together people and organizations to address local issues in education, income, health, and home. More information on how to get involved is at liveunitedcentralohio.org. And All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. My guest is Eric Foner, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. We're talking about his book, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery. If you have a question or comment for Eric Foner, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Last year, you wrote that the Civil War could be seen as an ominous harbinger of the 20th century total war, with its erasure of the distinction between civilian and military targets and infringements on civil liberties at home. I mean, that is really the Civil War. That was hugely groundbreaking. That was when guerrilla warfare started and lots of other things.
Well, the Civil War becomes, it doesn't, it starts out as a kind of typical 19th century war with, you know, two armies in the field, they have a battle, and they all go home, and nothing happens for weeks or months. By the end of the war, it's much more like World War I. I mean, obviously, they don't have aerial bombing, they don't have nuclear weapons, but it's much more like World War I. You have constant battles. Every day, the armies are in contact. You have trench warfare outside of Petersburg, and you have the armies attacking the, you know, basis of Southern society, burning crops, destroying homes. Sherman marching down through Georgia, you know, destroying. He doesn't kill civilians, but he does destroy property wherever he goes. So the distinction between civilian targets and military targets gets to be erased. And, of course, the suspension of civil liberties. I mean, this is what happens in war all the time, of course, including now. Lincoln suspends the writ of habeas corpus several times during the war. There are arbitrary arrests of people for criticizing the war, just as happens in World War I or in World War II with the internment of Japanese Americans, or even the USA Patriot Act lately, which infringes on many aspects of our civil liberties in the name of fighting a war. So, you know, James Madison in 1794 said, "The greatest danger to liberty is war. War is what undermines people's liberties." And that has been proven true over and over again in American history.
William in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, William.
My question is, did Lincoln believe that slaves could ever become a social equal of whites?
Social equal? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. In the 19th century, people talked about different kinds of equality, and they made fairly good, important distinctions. There was natural equality, which everybody should have, Lincoln said, the natural rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Blacks are equal. They are entitled to all those. Then there's political equality, civil equality, equality before the law. Lincoln says he evolves on that. He doesn't favor that before the war. By the end of the war, he's moving much closer to it. Social equality was something they felt at that time was just, you know, personal decision, who you invite to your house, who you associate with. That's not for the government to regulate. As I said before, Lincoln really felt that racism was very deeply ingrained in American life, and he didn't see a lot of prospect of what you might call social equality. But his focus was on these other areas, natural rights, political rights, civil rights, not the sort of day-to-day interactions with people, of people with each other, which the government really is not in a position to regulate.
There's been a longstanding debate, you write, over how to remember the Civil War, and that's probably true of any history or any war, or there had been. And you have remarked that forgetting some aspects of the past is as much a part of historical understanding as remembering. In your opinion, how far have we come as a nation in entirely remembering the Civil War?
Well, you know, we're now in the 150th anniversary celebration marking the Civil War, as you well know. And there is tremendous fascination with the war. One might say, look, people remember it all the time. There is, you know, people visit these battlefields. There are museums all over the place related to the Civil War. The TV presentations on the Civil War are very popular. But I think there is a reluctance, not among historians now, but among general public, to remember the centrality of slavery in the Civil War. Lincoln says in his second inaugural address, everybody knows that slavery was somehow the cause of the war. Everybody knew that at that time. Somehow. That is not so easy to figure out, but exactly how. But everybody knew without slavery, the Civil War is inexplicable. But today, I find when I lecture to groups, you know, which I do a lot, Many people said, no, slavery has nothing to do with the war. It's about states' rights. Well, but what was the right they were fighting for? The right to own slaves. Or it's about the tariff. No, I don't think so. 750,000 people don't go killing each other over the tariff. I'm sorry. But many people today seem to feel it's an accusation. If you say the Civil War was about slavery, you're somehow blaming their ancestors. You know, there is nobody alive today who owns a slave or is a slave. So it's you're not talking about blaming people. You're talking about explaining why people felt they had to go to war and continue this very bloody war for 4 years. Slavery is not the only aspect of it, but it's central to understanding the war. And, of course, because the issue of race is still fraught in our society in some ways, and because racial inequality still exists in many realms, the Civil War is relevant to the very moment. It's not just dead history, you know, like the Trojan War or something like that. We're still fighting over some of the same issues that they fought about in the Civil War.
Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Don.
Yes, I was thinking in the terms of which the professor is just speaking there. Basically, the terms for why the Civil War was fought and also the life of the former slaves after the Civil War was completed. The war, I think, was fought more for the North than for the South. The North had just gotten into the cotton gin and mass manufacturing and needed a whole lot of people to work in their factories. Now, they didn't have a whole lot of people up there, so they needed the people from the South, such as the slaves, to work in the North. Now, as the professor has also just said, Lincoln wasn't that concerned with the day-to-day life of the slave. I was wondering, I'm sure the professor doesn't have any records on this either, as to what the living conditions of the slave were, what kinds of jobs they held, what life expectancy was, how the health conditions of them were after they were not being taken care of by the plantation owners.
Well, a couple of points about your question or comment. First of all, I think it's not quite right to say that the North was interested in abolishing slavery so that they could get black labor up into the North. Quite the reverse. For many, many decades, blacks were pretty much excluded from northern jobs. You go to a factory in the 1890s in Cleveland or in Pittsburgh or in Chicago, you're not going to see a lot of black laborers. They get immigrants from Europe to work in these places. It's only after immigration is shut down, starting in 1914 when World War I breaks out in Europe, that you begin to get black the industrial jobs in the North opening up to blacks who then begin the so-called Great Migration. So that's 50 years after the Civil War. So most Northerners, who themselves, of course, largely held racist views, wanted slavery ended, but they wanted blacks to stay in the South, not to come up to the North. Of course, they wanted cotton to continue to be produced. Obviously, cotton was central to the economy at that time. But a lot of the people who wanted cotton produced wanted slavery to continue. They were much more certain that slaves would produce cotton than free laborers who might not desire to do so. As to the living conditions of slaves, you know, there is a lot of literature on this. Frederick Douglass writes about it himself, but, you know, he says, at one time I was with a master who didn't really treat me very well. I was with another one who fed me much better and the conditions were better. But he said, you know, that was not the issue. How I was treated was not what annoyed me or outraged me. It was being a slave that was the problem, not how much food you had, not what kind of house you lived in. It was being a slave that was that I had to resist and rebel against and run away. So you can't judge slavery purely by the physical living conditions. You have to talk about the fact that people had no right to marry legally, that they had no, their children could be sold away from them. They had no ability to rise in the social scale on the basis of their labor. Their lives were totally controlled by somebody else. Those are the things that made slavery intolerable in the eyes of Lincoln and of slaves themselves.
Thanks, Don, for your call. We appreciate it. June in Cleveland, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, June.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
I was wondering if you're going to get to me. I was just interested in this show. I'm so glad that I ran up on it just now.
Me too.
And I just was wondering, he said something about is no slavery at this time. It is slavery still in the world.
Well, there's that comment, and I know what you're talking about, but I think he was talking about what we're thinking about historically.
I'm talking about the United States of America, yes.
There are people who are enslaved in the world.
Unfortunately, yes, but not in the United States
and
today.
Are you, before I get to the point that I was making about Lincoln?
I want you to get to the point you were going to make about Lincoln.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, Lincoln was told to us in the sixth grade, I'm from Florida, mm-hmm. and my sixth grade teacher told me in our class that Lincoln did not free the slaves because he wanted to. He freed them because he didn't have no choice. And she said to keep that to ourselves because she wasn't supposed to tell anything about black history of any type in those days. Because that was in 1952. Mm-hmm. 1952, yes. I was 12. And so he didn't free those slaves because he liked them and was trying to help them. He didn't have no choice.
You know, most great political acts have many motives at the same time. Lincoln always hated slavery. There's no question about that. Did he free the slaves just because he wanted to? No, of course not. On the other hand, a person who was pro-slavery would not have done it. General McClellan, who was his opponent in the 1864 election, would have rescinded the Emancipation Proclamation if he had been elected because he was not anti-slavery. But absolutely, there were all sorts of factors that went into it. Military necessity, desire for black soldiers, desire to influence opinion in England and France. Many, many things went into the Emancipation Proclamation. But a man who was not anti-slavery would not have issued it in the first place.
June, thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Tom in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thank you. My question is about Lincoln in relation to the Black Hawk War and if that war had any influence on his thinking later on.
Well, Lincoln was a captain of a militia company. The Black Hawk War took place in Illinois. It was one of the many war, not really, you know, skirmishes involving Native Americans and white Americans out there. As Lincoln later said, I fought mosquitoes. I didn't actually fight any war back then. There was no combat that Lincoln was involved in. And unlike many pioneers or frontiersmen, Lincoln had no particular dislike for Indians. In fact, at one point, a Native American wandered into his militia army camp, and since they had seen no action, some of the young soldiers wanted to shoot him or tie him up or something. And Lincoln said, no, this guy's no harm to us. He's not, you know, let him go. He's not bothering us. So I don't think Lincoln's experience in the Black Hawk War was really a military experience, actually, in any significant way. And the Black Hawk War was a tiny, tiny thing compared to the Civil War. So I don't think anything he learned there would have been really relevant in the fighting of the Civil War.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Well, I was thinking maybe in how he might have thought about government's role towards minorities or...
I think you raise an interesting question, which is his attitude toward Native Americans, because Lincoln, as I said, he didn't hate Native Americans, but on the other hand, he had virtually no contact with them, unlike blacks eventually, and his policy toward Native Americans was pretty much the same as most of white America. That is, they should be moved out. They should be pushed out. They should be pushed to reservations. His whole image of the West was free white farmers should populate the West. He wanted to do justice to Native Americans, but he never quite really came to reconcile the fact that his concept of the West meant dispossessing Native Americans of their land. So, and he never had the chance to evolve in his views toward Native Americans the way he did, I think, in his views toward black Americans.
Thanks again, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Take care. The new Spielberg movie, Lincoln, is coming out next month, I guess. Have you heard much about it? Were you consulted?
I was not consulted.
Okay.
I have nothing.
How dare they?
I have nothing to do with it, and I'm glad. I am not a fan of Hollywood history.
Okay.
I assume it'll be more accurate than Lincoln the Vampire Hunter, a recent movie. But, it's coming out. I haven't seen it. I haven't read the script. I will probably have to pay my $10 or whatever to go to see it. But I'm not optimistic. I think Hollywood has a pretty poor track record in conveying history, and so we'll just have to see what happens.
In all the depictions of Lincoln in the movies and theater, have any of them come close to what you feel about him as a historian and everything you've written about him?
No.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, but let's see if we can just squeeze in David in Columbus. You're on the air. Welcome to the show, David. We're running out of time, though.
Hi, I had a quick question. I'd like the professor to compare Lincoln's policies with post-Civil War presidents such as Johnson and Grant.
Oh, boy. you have a few hours. We could go into this. But, you know, basically, I think Johnson, who succeeded Lincoln, I think was the worst president in American history. He lacked all of Lincoln's qualities of greatness, flexibility, open-mindedness, sympathy for those who were downtrodden. And it's a tragedy that Lincoln was assassinated at the point where the country was entering this extremely difficult period of post-war reconstruction and the period when making freedom a real benefit for blacks and for the society was on the agenda. So, you know, I can't really go into the details here now, but I think it's a tragedy that Reconstruction failed and that it was left almost another century to come back to the agenda of that time of racial equality in the United States.
Eric Foner, thanks so much for joining us today.
Very nice to be here.
Eric Foner, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, professor of history at Columbia University. We've been talking about his book, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery. Eric will be discussing that book tonight at Ohio Wesleyan University. It's a free presentation that's open to the public. For more information, you can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.